Well, good morning, and it is an absolute delight to be here, and I do bring a greeting from Shepherd's Theological Seminary. Perhaps you've not heard of Shepherd's, but I'd like you to, but I'll not say anything about it. I will, other than this, that we are a fully accredited seminary, but we don't look to the world for approval. We believe the Bible in all of its parts. We are full-throated inerrantists, not the kind of watered-down inerrancy, which is being embraced, unfortunately, by many today, and dispensational, premillennial. In other words, we would be a really good mission match for Indian Hills Community Church. So if you're at all interested in a seminary, we believe in grammatical, historical interpretation, and you know what? And I noticed Don Gertson is teaching on this in his Sunday school class, and may your tribe increase, Don. But geography is a huge part of history. If you're going to grammatical, historical interpretation, geography is important. And so one rather distinctive element of our seminary is that we take our students to Israel on our dime. We've raised the money to get all of our students to Israel on a good, solid study trip that we entirely underwrite because we believe it's so important. But again, I bring you greetings, but I'm thrilled to be with you. I'm going to ask you to go, first of all, in your Bibles this morning to 1 Timothy chapter 6. And I'm going to take you to a number of passages. And quite frankly, whether it's electronic or physical, I think it'd be good for you to have the text open before you as we go. But 1 Timothy 6, and it's a strange, well, it's not at all strange, but it's a little phrase, it's a little verse that really caught me up, that is drew me up short, is what I'm trying to say, some years ago as I was reading it. Paul says to Timothy, in 1 Timothy 6 and verse 13, and it's just a concluding statement, but he says to Timothy, his young co-worker, I urge you in the sight of God who gives life to all things, and then he says this, and before Christ Jesus who witnessed the good confession before Pontius Pilate. So Paul, in an almost offhand way, now think with me, makes reference to Jesus' confession before Pontius Pilate, and encourages Timothy to press himself into that mold. That's what he's saying. I want you to consciously, deliberately press yourself into the mold of Jesus as in the way that Jesus handled himself before Pontius Pilate. And he talks about the good confession. Now that drew me up short. And you know the what's really for our purpose this morning of note there is that Paul evidently knew that Timothy was a good student of that. The early Christian community gave itself carefully to studying the way Jesus handled himself before Pontius Pilate when he, Jesus, was on trial for his life, and there was much to be learned. And I thought, well, I don't know that I could intuitively process that. And so I gave myself to some effort to understanding the way Jesus handled himself before Pontius Pilate. And that's what I want us to think about this morning. I want us to think about the way Jesus, when he was on trial for his life, and he is taken to Pontius Pilate about 4:30 in the morning. I'd love to walk you through how we can get there, but the chronology unfolds rather carefully. And so it's about 4:30 in the morning when Jesus is taken to Pontius Pilate. He was arrested as he emerged from a time of prayer in Gethsemane there in the Valley of Kidron. Judas and the Sanhedrinists and the soldiers showed up, and Jesus was taken, first of all, to Caiaphas. Now, this is important to understand. Caiaphas was the high priest. He is, in fact, the primary villain of the crucifixion narrative, and Jesus is going to make that point explicitly. It was Caiaphas who, on Tuesday night, had laid in place a very, very complicated and careful plot to get Jesus arrested, tried, sentenced, and on his way to execution while the city slept. That's what's at stake. The Roman and Jewish enemies of Jesus have Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday ringing in their ears. Now, rehearse very quickly for yourself, the events of the Passion Week. On Sunday, Jesus had ridden into town and the entire city had erupted in wild welcome of Jesus as king. They welcomed him as king. Oh, I'd love to talk to you about that. It's a staggering scene, and it seems to me to elicit the question, how in the world did he get away with that? At a time when Rome was so paranoid about pretender kings, and in the place where she was the most nervous about pretender kings, because it was little Judea which had most often and most resolutely erupted in rebellion and so on, how is it that Jesus is able to ride into the city and the whole city welcomes him as king, and neither the Jewish nor the Roman authorities put a stop to it? And historians have some bogus answers to that question. But the fact is, the Bible is explicit. The reason Jesus got away with it is because the whole city erupted in wild-eyed welcome. Now, let me just say, and I haven't got time to develop this, but Jesus had orchestrated that. He had made that to happen. But the point is, he had made it by reason of the fact that he is wise as a serpent. But all that aside, the point is that his enemies are absolutely convinced that if the city realizes what they are doing, they will explode in anger and riot. And let me tell you this. This is really an important background, forgive me. But you have to understand, here we are. Rome is this monstrous empire which has taken control over the last less than a century of the entire Mediterranean world in Jesus' day. And Rome had divided her empire up into governing provinces. And over every province there was an authority. And he might be given different titles depending upon to whom he answered and so on. But wherever, in whatever province you found yourself, and whoever and whatever title the governor, the administrative leader was, he had two responsibilities. And if he fulfilled these two responsibilities, Rome was going to be happy with him and he's going to do her. If he didn't, if he failed neither one, he was going to be dispensed with very quickly. And the first responsibility was to collect the taxes, all right? Rome, I like to say, this was a long time ago, this is ancient history, so it's hard for us to really get in touch with, but the Roman Empire had spent itself into abject poverty with a most self-serving and short-sighted and counterproductive project, and so the government had spent themselves into poverty, and the only thing they could think of to remedy that situation was to tax their citizens more heavily. Now, that's hard for us to really get in touch with because it's so foreign to us. But honest to goodness, Rome demanded that they collect the taxes. But the second responsibility, and this is really plays into this story, was that they keep the peace. Rome had a huge army, somewhere over 350,000 professional soldiers, but they were stretched well beyond their limits. And if you couldn't keep peace, and if Rome had to bring soldiers in from another province and reinforce and so on, they were going to be done with you. Now, it's against that backdrop you have to understand what's going on with Pontius Pilate. I'll go back to the story. Jesus had been arrested somewhere around in the middle of the night, around midnight, outside of Gethsemane in the Kidron Valley. He had been taken to Caiaphas. Caiaphas, in the middle of the night, illegally convened the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin had one intent, one responsibility, and that is to find something that they could use against Jesus, because they had already arranged. They knew that they couldn't put him to death. They had to have the Romans put him to death. I'd like to talk to you about that tonight. But on the other hand, they had no charge to bring against Jesus. And so they were desperate, and finally they got Jesus to say out loud, Jesus did it willingly, when Caiaphas the high priest asked him, "Tell us, are you the Christ, the King?" Jesus said, "I am." All right, now I'm going to confuse you here, and I shouldn't. Jesus had claimed all throughout his ministry to be king, but he was wise as a serpent. You check the record, and everybody will acknowledge this, that Jesus was careful not to use the word Christ of himself. And the reason was because the word Christ means a lot of things to the Jewish mind, but above all other things, it means king. And Rome would not tolerate pretender kings. Does that make sense to you? And so Jesus used all sorts of Old Testament phrases and word pictures and titles and so on, which every Jewish ear would hear as claiming to be the promised Messiah. But he didn't use the word Christ. And thus his enemies, when they wanted to be able to go to Pilate and say, "This man insists he is a king, he is the king of the Jews, and therefore he's a threat to Rome, they couldn't find anybody who could say, yeah, I heard him say that. Does that make sense to you? That's why when they searched all night long for witnesses, they couldn't find witnesses. But finally, Caiaphas had said to Jesus, tell us, are you the Christ, the Son of the living God? And I think to Caiaphas's, this is the high priest now in the middle of the night, I think to Caiaphas' surprise and certainly delight, Jesus had said, I am. Okay, we got him. 70 men, middle of the night to be sure, but the Sanhedrin gathered have heard him say he is a king. Rome won't stand for pretender kings, so we got him. So now he's taken to Pilate. It's about 4:30 in the morning. This is what's going to happen. Initially, well, go to John 18. Go to John 18. Rather than just telling you, I should read to you. Look, let me say this. This is the way I had planned to say this. Matthew, Mark, and Luke all tell the story of Jesus before Pilate. They leave us with two remarkable emphases. One is that Jesus was absolutely silent. He never said a thing, except when he was alone with Pilate. And that's what was curious to me when I read, you read the synoptics, and, all right, don't leave John 18, but go back to Matthew 27. Just real quickly, I warned you I was going to hop you around. Go back to Matthew chapter 27, and this is Matthew's telling, the seminal telling. This is the first and authoritative telling of Jesus before Pilate. And he says in verse 2, they brought him to Pilate, and he tells about Judas hanging himself. But look at verse 11. It says, now Jesus stood before the governor. I'm in Matthew 27, verse 11. It says specifically, Jesus stood before the governor. Now, I'll come back to that. John's going to flesh this out. And the governor asked him, saying, are you the king of the Jews? And Jesus said, it is as you say, which is to say, yes, I am. I'll talk about that. But then, in verse 12, notice what it says. On the other hand, and there is a soft adversative here. It's a soft, but I think the contrast is there. While he was being accused by the chief priests and elders, he answered nothing. And Pilate would say to him, the judge would say to him, do you not hear how many things they testify against you? But he answered him not one word, so that the governor marveled greatly. So, and if you don't mind, don't lose Matthew. I got you in too many places, I know. But if you jump over to Mark real quickly, can you do this? Mark chapter 15, Mark makes much of the same point. I'm in Mark 15 and verse 2. And it says, verse 3, I'm sorry, the chief priest accused him of many things, but he answered nothing. And Pilate asked him again, saying, do you answer nothing? See how many things they testify against you? But he still answered nothing, so that Pilate marveled. So both Matthew and Mark, synoptic to be sure, make the point that Jesus was absolutely mute. So I'm saying to myself, wait a minute. Paul tells Timothy to go to school on the good confession, the way Jesus handled himself in his speaking when he was before Pilate. And yet Mark and Matthew make a big point of the fact that he said nothing. There's another emphasis that you find in the synoptics, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And that is Pilate's persuasion that Jesus is innocent. Now let me do the same thing. Let me take you back to Matthew chapter 27. Can you handle this? Am I driving you nuts? But By the way, can I just say this? God intends for you to understand this series of events as real historical events. And he's given us a fourfold testimony. And understand that the revelation is in the event, not just in the telling of the event. And so we need to know this event as carefully as possible. And do you know, this is a curious reality, that even though every one of the four Gospels is very selective, he's clearly picking from what happened in Jesus' life, what he, under the guiding Spirit of God, is convinced he needs to include. It's interesting that all four Gospels give about 40% of their record to the Passion Week. About two-fifths of all four Gospels, each of the four Gospels is given to the last week of Jesus' life, which means, number one, that we have a lot more detail. We can put it together with almost hour-by-hour sequence. And number two, what it means is that clearly God intends for us to understand this. So I say, here I am taking you from gospel to gospel, but it's a healthy exercise, and we need to learn to do it. Put the four Gospels together as you seek to understand the life of Jesus, and here we are in the last week of Jesus. But I go back to it. So I'm saying that you go back to Matthew 27. Here's the synoptics, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. We come away with two really strong emphases when we read their narrative of Jesus before Pilate. Number one is that Jesus was mute, that he said nothing. And number two is that Pilate was convinced that Jesus was innocent. And you'll see it especially in Luke. But let me show you in Matthew 27, where if you drop down to verse 15, which is the story of Barabbas, but it says in verse 18 that Pilate knew that that Jesus' enemies had handed him over because of envy. And verse 20 says that it was the chief priests and elders who persuaded the multitudes to demand Barabbas. But Pilate says in verse 21, what do you want me to do? Or which of these two would you have me deliver? And they say Barabbas. In verse 22, he says, what do you want me to do with Jesus who is called Messiah, Christ? And they say, let him be crucified. And notice verse 23, the governor said, what evil has he done? Now this is late into the experience before Pilate. And Pilate is pleading with the people. The man is innocent. But notice verse 24, and remember what I said earlier. When Pilate saw that he could not prevail at all, but rather there was a tumult was rising. In other words, there was about to be a riot, and he couldn't handle that. And so therefore, he took water, washed his hands before the multitude, saying, I am innocent of the blood of this just person. Notice what he says. As he washes his hands, this man is just. This is the presiding judge, after careful interrogation, announces, and this is one of five times when he insists, this man is guiltless. What do you want me to do with this just person? You see to it. He says, I'm innocent of the blood of this just person. Let me take you over to Luke. Luke chapter 23, and again, Luke really emphasizes this. Now, I'm saying for you, folks, just because I'm a lot of material here, but what I'm saying is that you read the three synoptics, their story of Jesus before Pontius Pilate, and you come away with, I mean, I come away with these twofold impressions. One reality is that Jesus remained silent the whole time. But the other is that Pilate was so convinced that Jesus was guiltless. And you'll see it most dramatically in chapter 23 of Luke, where he's brought to Pilate and Luke adds some to the story, very helpful. But if you drop down to verse 13, this is shortly before he turns Jesus over to be crucified. And it says in verse 13, Pilate, when he had called together the chief priests, the rulers, and the people, he said to them, you have brought this man to me as one who misleads the people, as a seditionist. If that word's new, sedition means rebellion, and Rome would not tolerate rebellion or sedition, pretender kings. And again, the only hope of the Jewish authorities that they could persuade Rome to crucify the Nazarene is that they could persuade the Romans that he was a threat, that he was a seditionist, a pretender king. So he says, you have brought this man to me as one who misleads the people. And indeed, having examined him in your presence, there is that about this sentence right here, which is a formal judicial ruling. He says, having examined this man in your presence, I have found no fault in this man concerning those things of which you accuse him. And then he adds to it, he says, no, neither did Herod. I sent you back to him. So here's his conclusion. Indeed, nothing deserving of death has been done by him. He goes on to say, I'll therefore chastise him, and release him. But they cry out, and notice if you will drop down to verse 22, I'm going to just pick the verses out. Verse 22, then Pilate said to Jesus' accusers the third time, why because they're crying, "Crucify him. What evil has he done? I have found no reason for death in him. I will therefore chastise him and let him go." All right, now, see if you can. Here's the thing. You realize, I think, that John is writing late. John is writing his gospel after the first three gospels, what we call the synoptics. Matthew, Mark, Luke have been in circulation for decades. John knows that his readers have the synoptics. And I think John, in many cases, is sort of filling out and making the record more intelligible. And I think John is going to do this for us because, well, primarily, here's the question. How came Pilate to be so unalterably convinced of Jesus' innocence? And by the way, you need to know that that's the more stunning against the backdrop of this reality that Pilate had on his hands the most severe, forgive me, hot potato any governor had ever been handed. And his career, and very, very much, very possibly his life, was very much at stake. Because if this erupted in the kind of riot that it could very well, the Romans were going to do something about it, and Pilate was going to lose his position, if not his life. And they had already arranged. You have to understand that on Tuesday night, the Sanhedrinists had arranged this whole plot. And the plot was simply this: we'll arrest him. We will bring to him to you while the city is still asleep, and you just crucify him. That was the deal. That was the handshake, if you don't mind. Why is it that Pilate, putting his own life in jeopardy, insists again and again, this man is innocent? Well, John helps us understand that. Go to John chapter 18. John gives us the fullest and most informative record of the actual interchange between Jesus and Pilate. And let's just follow the story. It's about 4:30 in the morning. Jesus, once again, having been arrested in the middle of the night and then taken to the home, the priestly villa of Caiaphas, and there Caiaphas had led in that nocturnal illegal trial until finally Jesus had confessed, "I am the Christ," and they felt, okay, now we got him. And so now, after a very quick rehearsal of that, they take Jesus to Pilate, and that's where we pick the story up in John 18 and verse 28. It says, they led Jesus from Caiaphas to the Praetorium, and it was early morning. But they, that is the Jewish accusers, the Sanhedrinists, the Jewish authorities, they did not go into the Praetorium. Now, that's the word I've got in my trusty, dusty New King James. You got a word like that? Praetorium? Sometimes they'll have that's the word. And it's a word which refers to the official, the domicile, the residence of the highest official, the highest Roman official in the place. So the Praetorium, all right, let me just say this, and I'm wandering for 30 seconds. There are two sites in Jerusalem which claim to be the Praetorium, yea, verily, the place where Jesus was tried before Pilate. The one is the Fortress Antonia. That's the one that is universally accepted over the years. It's the one that's the anchor point for the modern Via Dolorosa and so on. Might I just say, arrogantly, it's wrong, okay? And where Jesus was taken on the west side of the city, and it's one of the most delightful reasons to go to Israel today because you can stand there, you can rehearse this whole question, is just beautiful. It's a place where Herod the Great, when he built himself a beautiful, beautiful palace, which is really now, just even now being appreciated, but this beautiful palace on the western side of the city, he retrofitted to it a gate on the west side. And it was a gate which included a bema seat. And we know this from the records. And that gate was only uncovered a few years ago. And all the commotion and all the crowds and all the churches are up there at the Fortress Antonia. And you can stand on this beautiful hillside, and we always do it in the moonlight, and think through this whole story. And I can show you the gate where Jesus went in and out. But at any rate, that's the Praetorium. So now Jesus is being brought from the Jewish authorities to the Roman authority, to Pontius Pilate. And Jesus' enemies, the Jewish authorities, because it's Passover, they don't want to go in. So Pilate brings his judicial apparatus out into this gate on the west side. It's called the Essene Gate sometimes. But the point is that they bring him to the Praetorium. And look at verse 29. Pilate went out to them and said, "What accusation do you bring against this man?" And they answered and said unto him, "If he were not an evildoer, we would not have delivered him up to you." In other words, Pilate, play the game, for heaven's sakes. You know, we told you we were going to bring him to you. What in the world? Just take him and crucify him. And Pilate refuses. And what he does, drop down, well, it says, verse 31, Pilate said to them, "You take him and judge him according to your law." And therefore the Jews, time out real quickly. When John uses the word Jews, he almost always, and I would argue always, but there are a couple of places where you can question it, but he certainly here means the Jewish authorities. He does not mean the Jewish people. And certainly he can't mean that here because the city is asleep. These are only the Jewish authorities. So Pilate said to him, verse 31, Pilate said to them, "You take him and judge him according to your law." And therefore the Jewish authority said to him, "You know it's not lawful for us to put anyone to death." Then John gives us a very interesting verse in verse 32, but I'd like to talk about that tonight. But drop down to verse 33. Then Pilate entered the Praetorium. All right, now, have I lost you entirely, folks? Come back to me. Here's the issue. I'm saying that, number one, you read the synoptics, and they emphasize again and again how Jesus was silent. And yet Paul encourages Timothy to go to school on the confession, the good confession that he witnessed. So he spoke. Well, John's going to help us here. Number two, you're really impressed in the synoptics when they tell the story, and they always pick it up late in the drama, that is, drama of Jesus and Pilate, and Pilate is absolutely convinced of Jesus' innocence. How came that to be? All right, John's going to help us here. Because John tells us about two times where Jesus goes alone. He doesn't go. Pilate takes Jesus alone into the Praetorium. And so you have these two remarkable times where Jesus, on trial for his life, soon to be hanging from a cross, already horribly misused and manacled and bloodied. Two times, Pilate takes him inside the Praetorium. And you have conversations which only John records. And these have to be the good confession that Jesus witnessed before Pontius Pilate. Does that make sense to you? This is the only time that Jesus speaks. There's reference made to it in Matthew and Mark, just very, very quickly to this private conversation, but John fleshes it out for us. And I think he answers these two questions that I had in my mind. Number one, how come Paul talks about his good confession when the synoptics have him being silent? Well, he speaks to Pilate alone. And number two, how came Pilate to be convinced of Jesus' innocence? And it's this conversation. So, again, it's somewhere around 4:30. Jesus has been hauled by the Sanhedrinists from the home of Caiaphas, where he had confessed, "I am the Christ." Now he is hauled to Pilate. Pilate has, Jesus' enemies have tried to persuade him, "Just take him and crucify him." "No, I'm not going to do that." So he takes Jesus in to interrogate him. And here's the drama, verse 33. Pilate entered the Praetorium again and called Jesus and said to him, "Are you the King of the Jews?" All right, now folks, please think with me. I think this is so precious. Understand what's going on here. The judge, Pilate, is interrogating the accused Jesus. What is the accusation? The accusation is that Jesus the Nazarene is a seditionist who is a threat to Rome and therefore deserves and should die the death of a seditionist. And so Pilate simply says, and by the way, this is a bit of an aside, but whereas by Jewish law, It was illegal by Deuteronomic, by Mosaic law, it was illegal for a judge to interrogate the prisoner, or the accused, I should say. That was not true in Roman law. And Pilate was well within his bounds. He could do as ever he pleased. So he takes Jesus in and he says, "Are you the King of the Jews?" Now think, folks, honest to goodness, think with me. Do you hear how horribly and dangerously ambiguous this question is? By the way, folks, it's so important all throughout the life of Jesus. But I would say, remarkably in this scene, to take seriously the genuine humanity of Jesus. And we tend to think that he lives some sort of a, I always say it's the Clark Kent approach to Christology, you know, that there never was a Clark Kent, that was just Superman pretending. And we get the idea sometimes that Jesus was not like us, that he was just God dressed up like men, and he always had full exercise of his all divine powers. Were there times where the Spirit directed Jesus to know supernaturally? Absolutely. And so Jesus knew that there was a woman who had five husbands. He knew that Nathanael was an Israelite in whom there was no guile. But is there any biblical indication that Jesus lived his entire life, his mortal life, in that sort of ready exercise of, was he Superman secretly looking through buildings with his X-ray vision and so on? No. Jesus, everything about the Bible demonstrates. You know what, by the way? There was a time where the Spirit of God helped Peter to know that Ananias and Sapphira were lying, right? But we don't jump from that to the idea that Peter constantly could know supernaturally anything he chose to. And the reality is that Jesus had to ask questions. He had to learn. He had to know. He had to grow as a boy and so on. And so here he stands before Pilate, and Pilate asks him this question: "Are you the King of the Jews?" Well, the danger here is that that's a horribly ambiguous question, because on the one hand, Pilate might mean, "Are you a pretender king? Are you a seditionist? Are you trying to mount a rebellion against Rome? Because if you are, I, as a Roman official, I am absolutely under obligation to put you to death." On the other hand, he might mean, and there's good reason for Jesus to suspect he might mean, I'll show you in a moment, he might mean, "Are you the promised Messiah of the Hebrew Scriptures?" Now, look, folks, if the question is, "Are you a seditionist?" What's the answer? No. And Jesus cannot allow the possibility that the record be at all confused in this regard. Sedition is a crime by biblical standards. And we cannot have Jesus going to the cross even convicted if it's a false conviction. And so Jesus cannot simply allow, he can't afford the possibility that he'll misunderstand a question. On the other hand, if the question is, "Are you the promised Messiah of the Old Testament?" What's the answer to that question? See the point? And so Jesus, who is, all right, I am suggesting, and I think Paul suggested long before I, and with greater authority, that we ought to go to school on the way Jesus handled himself before Pontius Pilate. And one of the remarkable elements of this is his passion, Jesus' absolute commitment to the truth. He needs the truth to be spoken. And Pilate, the authority, he's a duly authorized judge, and he's asked a legitimate question: "Are you the King of the Jews?" But Jesus has to be so careful. And so what does he do? Look at the next verse. He says, now trace this whole context. Jesus says in verse 34, "Are you speaking for yourself about this, or did others tell you this concerning me?" Do you hear what he's saying? Pilate, are you just asking me from the bottom of your heart whether I am the King of the Jews, or are you asking me whether I am guilty of what others have told you about me? And Pilate answers the question. He says to Jesus, verse 35, "Am I a Jew? Your own nation and the chief priests have delivered you to me. What have you done?" So now Pilate has made it clear. What I'm asking is, are you a seditionist? Are you a threat politically, militarily to Rome? And Jesus' response, folks, and now I'm going to get myself all up in a lather, okay? Because, look, I think I can get away with saying this here. You're a well-taught church, remarkably well taught, and you understand some of these issues. But the next verse, John 18 and verse, I don't even know for sure what verse it is, 36, is probably one of the 10 most misused, horribly, horribly misused verses in the Bible. And specifically, all right, now I'm going to wander. Are you up for this? There is a whole school of evangelical thought. These are our brothers. We have much to learn from them in other areas, but not in this area, who insist that Jesus did not come to offer the kingdom to Israel, but to redefine the kingdom and take it away from Israel. And their thesis is, this is amillennialism, if you don't mind, covenantalism. Their thesis is basically that Jesus redefined the kingdom as a spiritual kingdom, not a physical kingdom. And so that spiritual kingdom is already here, the rule and reign of God in your hearts. All right, I'm not going to go anywhere with that. I reject it. I reject it with full heart. And I believe that that's pretty much, I know that's the passion of your pastor. My point is this, if you've got an amillennial friend and he accidentally drops his Bible, it's going to flop open to that verse. You know what I'm saying? This is their verse. My kingdom is not of this world. So that proves that it can't be a physical kingdom. All right, let's ask ourselves. Let's do a little honest exegesis. And I'm grabbing some high ground here, but I think I deserve it. Let's just ask ourselves. Jesus is on trial for his life. It's about 4:30 in the morning. He is alone in the palace of Herod, the praetorium, with Pontius Pilate, just the two of them, and he seizes the opportunity to deliver himself of a one-sentence lecture on kingdom theology that entirely unsays everything the Old Testament ever said. I don't think so. Folks, this is what drives me. This is a magisterial verse. This is what Jesus... Now, let's go back to the context. Pilate takes him as... Okay, let's go back one more step. Here comes the Jewish authorities. They bring him to Pilate, and Pilate says, what's the charge? Just crucify him. I'm not going to do that. Let me take him inside. So he takes him inside. Pilate knows this is a hot potato, and he says to him, are you a king? And Jesus says, no, wait a minute. Are you asking me if I'm the king of the Jews just as a question from your heart? Or are you asking me if I'm guilty of what I've been accused of? And Pilate says, look, am I a Jew? Your own people have delivered you to me as a judge, so they have insisted you are a criminal. What have you done? So he's answered the question. And here is Jesus' magisterial response. My kingdom is not of this world. Oh, I wonder what Jesus means by of this world. Maybe we ought to read the next phrase. If my kingdom were of this world, then would my servants fight that I wouldn't be delivered to you? Now listen, folks, honest to goodness, what's often missed here because we get off into theological spins about what kind of kingdom is. Listen, what's at stake here is this. What's happening is Jesus is building an absolutely irrefutable legal argument against the charge that he is a seditionist. It's an argument that so thoroughly convinces Pilate that from this time forward, as we read, Pilate will not be deterred from his conclusion that this man is innocent. How came Pilate to the persuasion, the unalterable persuasion, that Jesus is not a seditionist? Here's your answer. Are you a king? Well, what do you mean, Pilate? Are you asking me about who I am personally? Am I the Messiah? Or are you asking me about whether or not I'm a seditionist? I'm not a Jew. Your people have delivered. What have you done, Pilate? Think. By the way, you need to know this. Rome faced sedition every couple of decades in Israel. It was the hotbed of their entire empire when it came to sedition. And every sedition looked the same. Some pretender Messiah would gather a little militia around himself. They would go out into the hills, into the Jeshimon, find some fastness, some redoubt, some fortification out there in that bleak wilderness, and they could fall from there. They knew the caves, and they knew the watering holes and so on. Then they would come out, and they would fall on the caravans, and they would fall on the Romans, and they would just disrupt everything. And then when the Romans would come, because I always tell people we're in Israel, Israel's like one big paintball arcade in the sense that it's made for a guerrilla warfare, and which is the perpetual frustration of the Romans, who only knew brute, huge force. And so the point is, Pilate knew that there were seditions all the time. I mean, every couple, 3 decades, I could list them off for you. And in every case, they all looked the same. Some pretender Messiah king would find a secure place, and he would come out, and he would fall on the Romans. And Jesus says, think, Pilate, my kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, then would my servants fight that I wouldn't be delivered to you. So my kingdom is not from here. It doesn't come from thence, from that sort. And I think Pilate probably stood there and stroked his Roman chin and thought about it for a minute. And this is what he would have thought. He would have thought, you know, it's not like I live in a cave. This man has gone up down the countryside, much of it in my domain, much of it in Herod's as well, but he's been going up and down the countryside for, lo, the better part of 3 years, and there are hundreds of thousands of people who have attached themselves to him, and not one single one of those followers of the Nazarene have ever raised a sword, have ever shouted a military command, that they don't fight. And it's ludicrous. I think Pilate is thinking this. It's ludicrous to suggest that this man, he's not unknown to me. He's not unknown to anybody. There's nobody in the history of the Roman world, and perhaps the world, who's ever had more notoriety, more publicity, and been more public about everything he taught, and never, ever has he been any sort, or any of his followers. Does that make sense to you? What Jesus is doing here is not discussing kingdom theology. He's on trial for his life, for heaven's sakes, and he's building the argument, an argument which makes such sense to Pilate that he becomes unalterably convinced throughout the rest of the drama. This man is innocent. Does that make sense to you? Now, what comes next is what's most staggering. I got to be quick. I can barely see the clock. You're nervous about that, aren't you? In verse 37, and folks, I'm going to be honest with you, this just continually, every time I go back to it, it takes my breath away. Listen, I'll just tell you. Number one, I do not believe that Pilate, I will say on Jesus' authority that Jesus is, that Pilate is not the primary villain, and I don't think that ultimately he is really a villain in this account. Now, he's going to do that which is bottomlessly cowardly when he turns Jesus over. I'll come back to it in just a moment. But the fact is, Pilate is desperate to release Jesus. This is how Peter, remember, you go over to Acts 3 and verse 13, and there at silver and gold have I none episode, Peter says to the crowd there, he says, you insisted to be crucified when Pilate was determined to let him go. And Pilate makes all sorts of heroic attempts to release Jesus. He desperately doesn't want to release Jesus. And I would suggest to you that Jesus had already begun to impact the man Pilate. And the reason I say that primarily is because of the next verse. Because, now let's rehearse the whole story again. I'm taking a lot of time, but here's the deal. Jesus brought to Pilate, just crucify him. No, takes him inside. Are you the king of the Jews? Well, exactly what do you mean? I mean, what have you done? Pilate, it makes no sense. My kingdom does not come in worldly fashion. If it did, we would fight. We don't fight. And Pilate is convinced. But now, what takes my breath away is Pilate's next question. Because he says, and this is, he's going to address the other side of the ambiguity. He says in verse 37, are you a king? What could Pilate possibly be asking? I think he's saying to him, are you that long-awaited Messiah. And I love Jesus' answer. You know what? Jesus was a premillennialist. Because he said, you say rightly that I am a king. It was for this purpose that I was born. It was for this purpose that I came into this world, that I should testify to that truth. It's an article, but I think it's a demonstrative article, that I should testify to that truth. And anybody who is of the truth is going to hear my voice. That's a staggering moment. What? That had nothing to do. That is Pilate's question. Had absolutely nothing to do with the with the judicial proceedings. He's pretty much been convinced. But for Pilate to say, well, and by the way, you need to know that every historian who has ever spent any time, secular or Christian or whatever, any time with the first century will acknowledge that there was an absolute fever pitch of messianic expectation, not only among the Jews, but among the Roman world. And something had got a hold of Pilate's attention. But he simply says, well, are you a king? And Jesus affirms, absolutely, I'm a king. Can I tell you something here just real quickly here? This doesn't have much to do with my sermon. We sang this morning, and I sang with full throat, and I appreciate it, and it's so nicely done and so helpful. But folks, don't fixate over much on heaven, as in dying and going to another place. Your destiny is a kingdom on this earth. And you know, if I die today and I go to heaven, and that's a happiness, and it certainly beats all the alternatives, for heaven's sake. But the fact is that this whole world, I mean, I'm walking on streets of gold, whatever, but this whole world lies in the lap of the evil one. And everything that is sacred is profaned, and everything that is disgusting and perverted is celebrated. And that's what we need to be hungry to see fixed. What we ought to hunger for is that day when the knowledge of the glory of the Lord covers the earth as water covers the sea. This is what drives me. Okay, this is what bothers me about the doctrine that the kingdom is already here, that this is as good as God can do with human history. Oh, no, it's not. Oh, I so long for the day when every knee bows and every tongue confesses that Jesus is the Christ to the glory of God the Father. Is that happening in Lincoln, Nebraska? Because it ain't happening in Cary, North Carolina. It's not here. And we need to be hungry for it. And that's why Jesus said, you say rightly that I'm a king. It's for this reason that I was born, for this reason I came into the world to testify to that reality, that I am the king who is going to establish a reign of righteousness on this earth where God's people will be exalted and the name of God will be glorified by every tongue. Oh, that's a happy thought, don't you think? All right, I got to finish the story and I got just a couple minutes. This is what happens. Actually, a lot happens, but I want you to go to John 19. Pilate comes out after, I'm just going to tell the story very quickly. Pilate comes out to the Sanhedrin. Now, you have to understand, I trust you understand, that the conversation that we just described happened privately, just Jesus and Pilate inside the Praetorium. Now he comes back out, goes up to his bema seat. I can show you that bema seat. You can sit almost on that bema seat today. It's been uncovered. But at any rate, he goes back to his bema seat, and for the first time, he announces, this man is guiltless. I find no fault in him. And they cry, no, he's a troublemaker ever since Galilee, that's Herod Antipas's. Herod Antipas is inside, so he sends him to Herod. Herod, nothing happens there. There, Herod concurs that there's no reason for him to die, sends him back. Meanwhile, Pilate has been thinking, and he comes up with a plan. And his plan is, I will offer the people the question, Jesus or Barabbas. I got to be quick here. And I think Pilate is thinking to himself, I know that those that Jesus' enemies, the authorities, are just envious of him. And I know that on Sunday, the whole city welcomed him as king, and on Monday, he cleansed the temple, and they all cheered him, and on Tuesday, he put all of his enemies to silence, and they all cheered him. So certainly the people love him. So he decided, Pilate decided, I know what I can do. I know how I can get out of this. I'll put it to the people. So he asked the people. By this time, the city is waking up. And the news would have traveled like wildfire throughout that swollen city that this Nazarene, whom they welcomed as king on Sunday, is now on trial for his life, and that it's very open and accessible. So they make their way over to that place, and Pilate looks out over the crowd, and he says, "Who would you have me give you, Barabbas or Jesus?" And of course, the Bible says again and again that the chief priests and the Sadducees persuaded the people to ask for Barabbas. And Pilate is stunned. He thought this would work. And he says, "What do you want me to do with Jesus, whom you call the Christ? Crucify him." And then, of course, Pilate decides that perhaps he can sate the bloodthirstiness of the crowds by scourging Jesus. So he takes Jesus into the praetorium, and Jesus is scourged. Now he's brought out. And Pilate stands Jesus before the multitude, now bloodied and beaten awfully. And he stands back and he says, "Behold the man," as if to say, "You're telling me that this man is a threat to Rome. Have you had enough?" But they continue to cry out, "No, no, crucify him." And Pilate finally says, and it's in John 19 and verse 5. John 19 and verse 5. Actually, verse 6. When the chief priests and officials saw him, that is, having been scourged, they cried out, saying, "Crucify him." Pilate said to them, "You take him and crucify him, for I find no fault in him." That's the fifth time he has said, "I'm not going to do it." And then the Jewish authorities play their, well, they make this appeal in verse 7. And oh, I should have time, but I'm telling you, this is such a key verse. They say in John 19, 7, "If you won't crucify him as a seditionist, then we have a law. And by our law, he ought to die because he made himself the Son of God." That's why Jesus went to the cross, because he claimed to be the Son of God. Well, when Pilate heard that, he was only the more afraid, and so he took Jesus in. And this is, with this we're done, but Jesus, this is the second. Now, again, Paul says to Timothy, "I adjure thee by the good confession that Jesus witnessed." Jesus was absolutely mute except when he was alone with Pilate. The first time was the conversation we already discussed. Let's look at the second one. And this is one of the most compelling scenes in all of the Gospels, although I'm going to read it differently than you've heard before, and I'm just going to suggest it to you. So if you pick it up at verse 8, "When Pilate heard that saying," that is the Jesus' enemy saying, "He claims to be the Son of God," "he was the more afraid. He went again into the praetorium, and he said to Jesus," all right, think with me, I know I'm late, but just give me 3 minutes. "He said to Jesus, 'Where are you from?'" Do you hear what he's saying? Who in the world are you? Who could generate this kind of anger? Where are you from? And Jesus won't answer. It says in verse 9, Jesus gave him no answer. And Pilate said to him, "Are you not speaking to me? Don't you know that I have power to crucify you and power to release you?" And Jesus answered, verse 11. Now listen, I'm going to put a spin. I say a spin. I don't think it's a spin. I'm going to read this differently than I think what you're used to. I just put it before you. Because Jesus answered and said, "You could have no power, no authority, no ecstasy, and no, you'd have no authority at all against me unless it had been given you from above. Therefore," remember that, "therefore, the one who delivered me to you has the greater sin." Now, folks, stay with me. The standard way to read that first part of that verse is that Jesus has reference when he says "from above" to his Father, right? So he is saying to Pilate, "You would have no authority unless my Father had given it to you." In which case, Jesus is saying something like, "Pilate, don't take quite so much to yourself. I don't think that's what it means." And for a couple of reasons. One is, I don't think Jesus would have spoken that way. But the other one is, you can't make any sense of the rest of the verse. "Therefore, who's the one who handed me over to you?" That's Caiaphas. So how does it make sense for Jesus to say, "Pilate, you're not that big a deal. You only have this because my Father in heaven gave it to you. Therefore, Caiaphas is the greater sinner." I can't make that logical transition. I'm convinced with many commentators, by the way, that from above means from Roman authorities above you. So what Jesus is saying to Pilate is, Pilate, you would have no authority here whatever were it not for the fact that you were assigned this jurisdiction by authorities above you. Matter of fact, and now my imagination is going to take off with me, but I picture, now again, this is for certain. They are alone in the praetorium, in the courtyard of the marvelous palace there, and it's just Jesus and Pilate. And Pilate says, who are you? Jesus won't speak. He says, don't you realize it's up to me to decide whether you live or die? And I like to picture Jesus with his manacled hands and his, by now he's been scourged and bloodied, and he's wearing the crown of thorns and so on. But I like to picture him maybe stepping forward and grabbing Pilate by the shoulders and looking into his eye and say, Pilate, you'd have no authority here at all, except it was given to you by your superiors. In other words, you didn't chase me down. This is not your fight. You've done everything you can to release me. You'd have no authority. Now it makes sense to say, therefore, the one who has the greater sin is the one who did, in fact, lay a plot and chase me down and have me arrested in the middle of the night and convene an illegal trial to come up with a charge and now bring me to you and try and get you to crucify me without even any sort of procedure. Pilate, you're only here because it's your official assignment. I think that's what Jesus is saying. But we're still left with this question. What is Jesus saying? What is he trying to say? All right. I think Jesus is giving Pilate permission to go ahead. You have to understand that Jesus has to go to the cross, and Pilate has a huge role to play. And in this drama, he has discovered a reserve of character that we might not have expected of him. And he is doing everything he can to avoid crucifying Jesus. And what happens is that Pilate goes back out and announces again. Well, the Bible says that he tried the more carefully to release Jesus. But now the Jewish authorities said, played their trump card, if you don't crucify him, we're going to tell Caesar. Pilate, we know a lot about Pilate. A lot of what we think we know about Pilate's wrong, by the way. The popular perception of Pilate is horribly, horribly skewed. But at any rate, leave that alone. We know that Pilate had used up all of his coupons back there in Rome. We know that he was aware that he would not survive if they went back and caused that kind of trouble for him in Rome. But I think it's with the words of Jesus whispering somewhere in the back of his mind that Pilate, realizing a riot's about to happen, washes his hand, says, I'm not going to have anything to do with the death of this just man. And I picture him perhaps with stooped shoulders, laying down the towel, coming down off of his bema, walking back into that gate. And now the soldiers do, in fact, take Jesus and crucify him. Now, where I started was this. Paul told Timothy he ought to go to school on the way Jesus handled himself. I'm saying there is so much for us to learn from the way he handled himself. We can learn about his commitment to the truth, how he carefully teased out the precise meaning of Pilate's question. He is absolutely committed to the Father's will. He knows it's imperative that he go to the cross, and he moves methodically even here toward the cross. But I'll tell you something else. I think one of the lessons we can learn is that in this awful situation, Jesus had a genuine heart of love for the man Pilate. And he tenderly, tenderly dealt with Pilate, answered his questions. And the way the story ends, and I tell people, and not to universal acclaim, that I am more than a little bit suspicious that we're going to see Pilate in glory. And the reason is because of the last note that we have here in this story. And I'll just read it to you. You're familiar with it. in John 19 and verse 19, it talks about how Jesus was taken and placed on a cross. And then it says this, "Now Pilate wrote a title and put it on the cross, and the writing was, Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews." And you remember that it says, John says that many of the Jews read this time, many of the Jewish leaders, because the place where Jesus was crucified was near the city that was public, and he wrote it in Hebrew, Greek, and Latin, for heaven's sakes. This was not to be missed. And therefore, they came back to Pilate, and they said, wait, don't write the King of the Jews, write, he said, I am the King of the Jews. Do you hear what's going on there? They're saying, don't write he's King of the Jews. Write that he was a seditionist, that he was crucified for claiming that he was King of the Jews. And Pilate said, what I've written, I've written. Now, two notes and I'm done. Number one, I can't help but connect what Jesus had told Pilate in that first interview. When Pilate, for whatever reason, had said, well, are you a king? You say rightly that I'm a king. And it was for this reason that I was born into this world. And anybody who loves the truth is going to confess that I am the king. And now, do you realize the dynamics of a Roman prefect over the body of a crucified criminal writing? Not he claimed. There's nothing of indictment here. Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews. Pilate didn't have to write that. There's something of Daniel 4 in that, Nebuchadnezzar's testimony. So, I'll just leave you with this. Paul said to Timothy, go to school on the way Jesus handled himself before Pontius Pilate. You and I, corporately, individually, very possibly may find ourselves in this or that situation where there is an angry authority of some sort who is confronting us and indicting us and challenging us. This may very well be in ways that we haven't appreciated and haven't experienced. That may be our experience in the near future. Go to school on the way Jesus handled himself before Pontius Pilate. Amen. Father, thank you so much for the time now and for the patience of these dear folk. And I'd pray, we thank you for your son and so much that we learn from him. Above all, we thank you for the death that he died. It was a death we never could have died. But Father, we thank you even for the way he bore testimony to the man Pilate. And Father, might we indeed be moved and instructed and shaped by the good confession that Jesus witnessed before Pontius Pilate. And we pray that in his name. Amen.